All right, so I'm Arlo, and I'm gonna yammer at y'all for as little of this time as I possibly can. We're gonna talk about fluid code in the real world, how to keep your design malleable, even while dealing with legacy situations. When I say we're going to talk, what I mean is this entire presentation is 22 slides, including the four that I'm required by the conference to put in there. And I intend to go through those very, very quickly. So a lot of the content will come from you all as we discuss and tell stories and so on. So if you're expecting to sit back and relax and observe for an hour, well, you're welcome to do that as long as someone else in the audience is pulling your weight. So, I just want to start off with sort of a little context setting. So we're talking about the real world. How much does that describe projects you're on or have been on? Yeah. Yeah, we've all been there. I've been on a lot of those. I just want to have you, so in which ways do you think that what I just showed, that sequence of images, really ties well to what we're going to talk about here? Changing design fluidly and easily. Thoughts? Perfect. Any other specific ways that those slides remind you of previous projects or come to play as you're trying to alter the design of your code? Lots of bugs.
It's really hard to avoid.
It's really hard to avoid the bugs being, yeah. Yeah, that's life. So maybe we can try and find some ways in which that doesn't have to be life, or at least less. Yeah.
Say that design change costs a lot less than not changing the design.
Design change costs a lot less than not changing the design. So, sometimes, yeah. It's an interesting insight and codicil. Yeah. Proper use of design patterns and architecture, was that help or don't help mitigate?
Help.
Help mitigate, yes. And I would have accepted it if you'd said don't help mitigate as well, because I've seen both cases, right? Yeah. What was that?
Can help.
Can help, certainly can help, yeah. Other ways in which it applies? Okay, so I want to I want each of you to talk with a neighbor. You're going to pair up. Don't pair up with the person next to you because the odds are you know that person. So pair up with someone either sitting behind you or in front of you, and talk about how much does design change cost on your projects, and where does that cost come from? You know, how do you pay the cost? What are the sources of that cost? Just in a couple of your more recent projects, when you're going to change the design, how much does it cost and why? Okay. So what are some insights that people had? What are some insights that people have had from the discussion? What were some things that came up?
So you asked about how do you pay the cost of a design change, and one of the things we said was the cost of it depends on when it comes and how big it is, but in a lot of cases, at least in my experience, you pay the cost in terms of an opportunity cost. So when we get a design change and we have to absorb that, the cost of that is we're pushing something else out of the sprint or pushing something else out of the release that has to pay the cost of absorbing that change.
Okay, so I heard a couple of things there. One is the cost, how much something costs depends on when it comes in. Presumably later changes costing more.
Absolutely.
For you guys? Okay. And then the other one is that a lot of what you pay when you have a change is in terms of opportunity cost. It's that you're going to slide out some other piece of work in order to make a design change. Okay. Yeah?
We pretty much agree that the size of the change matters and the size of the components. So decoupling can seriously reduce the cost. Because if it's a small enough change, then you can just rip something out, put a new thing in. You don't really feel anything but the change itself. And you're kind of going to an interface and keeping your design clean, then as long as the intent doesn't change, then the design will have a very small ripple effect.
Okay, so I heard a couple of things there. One is a lot of the cost of the change depends on the scope that it impacts. And so if you have a more loosely coupled system, then the odds are it won't ripple as far, and that'll reduce the cost. You also mentioned that if the change is in line with the system's expectations, so that it aligns with those decouplings, then it's cheap. But with any of those, you could have an unexpected style that those decouplings don't protect from. Is that right? Accurate? Yeah. Yeah?
You're also making an assumption that this is bad.
Yeah, so there's times, in fact, I would hope many of the times, where you do a design change and it pays for itself after some period of time, right? And so that you get something out of it of doing that change. Yeah. Right, so you got to compare the cost of changing to the cost of not changing, and you brought up another interesting cost that people hadn't mentioned before, which is bugs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, each design has a certain rate of bugs that it will cause you to write, and so yeah, that's something to keep in mind. Yep. Any other insights?
I would bring one more insight. So, changing compared to what?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's something about what it's changing with respect to. So if you've got a process whereby you do some design without sign-off, you start working on that design, and then the design changes before the sign-offs, you need to pay the cost. But presumably if you hadn't started working on it, then you wouldn't have to pay the cost. And so that's where it depends what changed and happened when.
We
wouldn't pay a direct cost on that, right? Other insights?
One other cost can be a person's job.
Cost can be a person's job. Tell me more.
I've seen where software gets pushed out into a current customer base whereby certain customers can't adapt to the new changes. It's more too difficult for them than they get fired.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so especially if there's a user design change or something like that, then it can have a ripple effect where you roll it out to your customers and some customers can't adapt to the change, and the the individuals who can't adapt get fired and replaced by someone who can. Yeah, that can happen. Yeah?
Not something we discussed, but it also depends on the prior investments in the project. If you have a quality system in place that, for example, has regression tests in place, the design change might actually be a little bit smaller because you have faster insights. Mm-hmm. And when you have to decide if you're going to a testing effort manually with three people for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So the
cost depends on previous infrastructure investments. Certainly, there are infrastructure investments like a set of automated developer tests that can reduce the cost of change. Yeah. So that ways to reduce the cost of change is a lot of what we're going to talk about today. So yeah.
So some designs actually, for example, you put it into production and then you realize that your design is flawed. And then you have rethought process on, our system can't handle it. So how do we adapt?
Yeah. So sometimes you'll find the design flaw only once it goes to production. And we thought that handling every request on its own thread was a great idea until we saw what that meant for load on the machine, or similar sorts of problems. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So. In this session, we're going to talk about ways to reduce the cost of making changes in design. And here I am talking about the technical design of a product. So it's less about changes in user experience design or that sort of stuff. There are probably parallels. Feel free to draw them. But I'm talking about technical design. One of the things that came up a little bit. We talked some about the bugs and some about the opportunity costs. A lot of the costs that you pay are in terms of risks and unknowns. When I go to make a change, I introduce the probability of there being new bugs. There may be bugs, there may not be bugs, right? But there's a probability of introducing defects. And so I have to search for them, and then I have to fix them. And we remember that bug mountain and that first thing where first write a bunch of code and introduce a lot of defects and then you pay it down. The problem is that I'm introducing the chance of those defects. So what we're going to talk about are what are ways that we can do that reduce the probability of introducing especially defects cost. So this doesn't talk as much about opportunity costs. We'll talk a little bit about that. But it's mostly how do you avoid paying the stabilization period and new defects. And the interesting twist on it, of course, is legacy code. Because none of us are in a greenfield project. Some of us may be on a project that only has a couple of weeks of code in it and was greenfield a couple weeks ago. but I suspect none of us are in an actual greenfield project today. and I happily count myself among that number. So what we're going to be talking about here, the context that everything's going to be set in, is emergent design. So emergent design gets brought up a lot in the Agile community, and it quite often gets seen as design chaos. Rather than planning and predicting where we're going to go and how the system should work, we're just going to change it all the time. That's not really what we're talking about here. What we're talking about with emergent design is a combination of predictive and reactive design. Right? So what do predictive and reactive design mean? First, predictive idea. Predictive design, what's that mean? What do people think of? Big design up front, so that's the negative form of it.
Small design up front.
Small design up front.
Design to evolve.
Design, what was that?
Design to scale.
Design to scale. Yeah. So it's these pre-thinking to solve some sort of a problem to build. So that sort of stuff. Okay. Reactive design. What is that? So adapting to change in requirements and environment, how? Testing, modularity, reducing coupling, what did you say? iteration, okay. Yeah, testability. So these are a lot of the things that we might be introducing as we're doing reactive design. So what sort of thinking and thought process, what activities are we doing in predictive design? Predictive. There are some people who do do predictive design with refactoring, but they're few enough that I'm going to assume that's in the other camp. So predictive design. What are the activities and the ways of thinking that people are doing there?
Database design.
Players. Players and contracts between the players. So we're envisioning some state. We're thinking through problems. Okay. I like to think of that as we're inventing. Right. We identify problems that we need to address, and then we invent solutions for them. So in reactive design, what are we doing? The same. We're identifying problems and solving them. I would agree that much is the same. But what's the way that we're thinking? What's the activity we're doing?
We're reacting to a concrete issue. When you're doing predictive, you're imagining what could be, and then you're trying to design to fulfill that. And reacting, it means you already got the situation, then you're forced to change based on that reality.
Okay, so in predictive, you're imagining what could happen, and you're designing to ensure that the good things of that happen and the bad ones don't. And in reactive, you're observing what did happen, and you're reacting to fix it. Okay, so that's one difference. Yeah. So what sort of thinking are we doing? What activities are we doing here?
Learning.
Learning is a big part of that, of reactive. Yeah.
Analysis.
Measurement. Yeah. What are some other verbs that come into play for reactive?
Tracking.
Okay. Minimize change or maximize change. Everyone has a policy on change, right? It varies. Yeah. Yeah. So I think of reactive design as fundamentally about sensing. You know, sensing, learning, and inspect, adapt. So in a sense, with emergent design, what we're talking about is inventing and sensing. In predictive design alone, we invent, but we don't have much ability to sense because we don't have the thing in front of us. We can't measure. We can't, et cetera. In reactive, if we just use reactive design alone, then great, we can sense a problem after it has occurred, but we have very little ability to prevent one, right? And we can't invent and really look forward to imagine the next possible thing. So emergent design is a blending of those two, where we are continuously both inventing and sensing and learning. So I want to talk a little bit about the process whereby we go about doing that. And this is a process that we're going to follow when we do the hands-on portion in like 10 minutes or so. So it might even be relevant today. So the first thing that I do is I ask myself a question. Why change anything? Why am I here? Increase value. That's a good answer. So what are some good answers to that question, and what are some bad answers to that question? Let's start with some good answers. So increase value is a good answer. What's another good answer?
Customer requirement.
Changing laws. Changing, what was that? Laws.
Loss reduction, waste.
Oh, loss and, waste, reduce waste. What's another good answer?
Fix
bugs, yes. Or fix a bug farm. You know, prevent me developing new bugs here, because I know historically I often do. Okay.
Regulatory change.
Okay. What are some bad answers?
Because
I want to change it. Because I like change. Yeah. What's another bad answer? There are commonly people will ask this question to themselves and then give one of the bad answers, and they'll end up making a change somewhere where their time could be better spent somewhere else, right? Gold plating, and what was that? Because this is more interesting than that other thing that I should be doing. Yeah.
Because I can.
Because, how about, because I don't like his design.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not invented here.
I need my own hash table, damn it. Yeah. So yeah, the first thing that we want to ask ourselves is why am I even here? And we ask that partially for the opportunity cost, so that we don't start making changes in places where we could be doing it else. We could be doing better work elsewhere. But we also ask that because as I go through this thing, I'm going to do my work differently. If my goal here is to implement a feature, then what am I going to do? I'm going to do the refactorings that enable implementing that feature. I'm going to think about the customer a lot. I'm going to think about that feature, how it aligns with other scenarios. I'm going to make sure that my design matches the domain. I'm going to be doing a lot of that sort of stuff, right? If my goal is to eliminate a bug farm, what am I going to do? I'm going to look at the way that developers are thinking about the problem and the way that the code is making it easy to think about the problem and why those aren't in alignment. And I'm going to try and design that so that the two think in the same way. I'm going to look for common sorts of bugs, like off by ones and uninitialized variables, and try and prevent it and make those not possible. Right. So I'm going to still doing refactoring, still doing design, but with very different goals. Right. I might be over the same set of code, so I'm going to end up with different designs. So the next step of the process is okay. I've decided I'm going to make a change here, and I've decided that I'm adding a new feature. What's my next goal? The key insight here is that my next goal is not to add a new feature. Write a test for it so I know when to stop. That might be a good next step. There are a number of possible good next steps. The key is that I want to think of my goal, that why I'm here, not as a single step, but as the culmination of a series of steps. We're going to do an iterative process to get to that. And I'm going to pick intermediate goals. So maybe it's I need to write some tests around it and get some testability on the current state because it wasn't tested enough, and I want to make sure I don't break it when I add the new stuff. That might be the good first step. Maybe the good first step is this thing is pretty easy to implement half of the feature, but another half I'm going to need to, it doesn't store the data in the right place. So I need to refactor where the data is stored. Or, maybe it's I just need to understand the users need better, right? So I'm going to go talk to the customer and figure out what I should actually be doing here.
Risk mitigation.
My first step might be to analyze the risks that are that are here and see how to mitigate them. Yeah, absolutely. So now that I've identified my next goal, I want to write the first couple of tests around the current behavior before I add the new stuff, because the current behavior isn't tested. This is legacy code after all. So the next thing is, what's one provable step? So this is legacy code. Can I just write a test in a provable way that I know doesn't break anything? Probably not. There are tools for it. I might be able to hack in, and with enough mocks and things, I might be able to. But the odds are I might be facing one of the projects that I'm helping people with. There's a 17,000-line function. We need to completely rewrite that function to go to a new platform, and we need to be bug-for-bug compatible. That function has been written over 25 years. Nobody knows what it does, right? And I can't just write a test for it. So what's my first step?
See what it does.
Start figuring out what the hell it does. Yeah, start finding little chunks of it that I can start figuring out what they do. So I might have identified my first goal is to write one test over one business case. But my first provable step might be, I want to do an extract method refactoring on these four lines of code so that I can inject data and see what happens. Right? So it might be many, many small steps before I can get to the point of actually writing that one test. Right. Step four, do it. So this is the interesting one. Check in or revert. So the reason that I asked for that step to be provable in three is so that I know whether to check in or revert. And when I'm working here, I'm going to take that small provable step, and if it doesn't do exactly what I expect, if my proof for it says that it wasn't perfect, I'm going to roll back all of my code and then define a new step or try again. Right. What does this mean about the size of scope of work that I'm doing in one of these steps?
Minimal.
Minimal. It's pretty darn small if I'm comfortable rolling it back on a first unexpected thing. And then, of course, the last is this is an iterative process. So what's next? Go back to one of the first three questions and just iterate. And this is basically three nested loops that you go through until you've completed this change and the next one and the next one and the next one forever. Whatever my provable step is. So in the example that I've been using of I wanted to add a feature to this 17,000 line function, the first goal is to get a test under it, but it has poor testability. My first step is to do an extract method on the couple of lines that I'm going to change so I can modify the data. Then I will execute one extract method refactoring and ensure that behavior hasn't changed. Okay. And the how do I prove that that doesn't work? Well, I might have static analysis tools that can prove that it compiles to identical, or I might have a set of pinning tests, or I might have a fleet of testers, or hopefully something towards the cheaper end. but I do some way to prove it, and then I commit that. So we talked about predictive and reactive design. So in this process, what is predictive and what is reactive? Where am I inventing and where am I sensing? So that first, the first question, what am I doing there? Is it reactive? I hear some predictive too? Yeah, I actually think of it as predictive. Now I can hear the arguments for reactive, and in fact, tell me what your argument is, because I suspect there are a number of good ones. Yeah, for why it was reactive.
There could be a requirement that came in, so it's reality. It's not something that I have to think about. Now for a billion new business needs to change it.
Yeah. So I am reacting to a reality that there has been a change in requirement, so.
But I'm just assuming that too. I mean, sometimes you're just doing, you've got a spike. You're doing
yeah.
Analysis and you find it like, okay.
Yeah, so you were going to say?
Well, I was going to say predictive because, you might be reacting to something, but what you decide to do you decide to change something? That's a predictive response to that thing that came in. So that was my train.
Yeah, so your thinking is that there might have been, there was something that caused you to make an instigation to do a change, but you're now doing a fully predictive invention-based thinking on the basis of that. Okay.
If I may, changing the, in order to increase value or reduce cost or waste, then I am reacting to either an opportunity or a cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So the reason that I'm doing something is reactive, but the goal, as I think of the goal, that's where you do invention. Okay, that's reasonable. Now, I tend to think of the first step as invention, as predictive, because it is in response to some change in the environment or something. But why am I changing this? And what change am I going to make to this is all invention predictive stuff, right? As opposed to changing something else, right? Yeah. So the next one. All right, next one. What is our next goal?
Predictive?
Mostly predictive? Yeah. So I will agree 90%. I say a little bit of sense here. And the reason is the first goal, entirely predictive. Totally agree. What about your second one? You're reacting to the change that you just made, and you're modifying the invention that you did, right? So yeah, the first, I find that as I iterate through this, it starts out the first goals are very predictive, and the last ones may be very, very sensing, and it sort of shifts over time. Right? Oh, right. So what do you think the next one is? Yeah, one provable step. Yeah, I would say that's pretty much always going to be reactive sensing, right? I've decided where I'm going to go. I've already decided that. Now I just am looking at the code and seeing what's one step to get from here to there. Totally responsive thinking, right? Doing it. Hey, go. Okay, so doing it. Yeah, so so it's harder to think of this in terms of predict versus react, but in terms of invent versus sense.
Is it write the code or write the group?
This is mostly write the code. depending, if you're doing a lot of test first, maybe it also involves running some proof, but it's predominantly writing the code. So reactive, otherwise you wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah.
And you were saying?
Mostly invention because it's more about the how than the what.
Invention because it's more about the how than the what. Yeah. I think, again, both of them are legitimate answers. I tend to go on the side of invention because I find that, at least for me, with those earlier steps, I've identified my next goal and the next change that I want to do. And now what I'm looking at is, how am I going to execute this change? How am I going to safely do it in this code base? How am I going to prove it? And a lot of that is, again, this invention thinking ahead sort of stuff, right? A very small scope, but it's thinking ahead a little bit. So check in or revert?
Sense,
yeah. And what's next? Sense. I would agree with sense. That's again a measure where we're at, and then decide on the basis of that. So, what do we notice as we go through this process? Is this predictive design? It's both. Yeah. So, when we're talking about emergent design in the Agile community, this is what we're talking about. We're not talking about doing an upfront design at the beginning of the release and then a fully reactive design for the next 3 months. We're talking about every single moment, every single change. I'm going through this loop very, very quickly. When my wife and I are coding, we go through that inner loop every 90 seconds. And every time through that loop, I'm doing both predictive and reflective design. So I mentioned fast. This is one of those things that it's pretty easy to describe and it's pretty easy to learn. You could print that list of six steps, stick it on your cube wall, and go. But it takes forever to master it. Right? And the question is, how can you continually get better? Yeah, I cheated and given you the answer. So what's the metric that you can use to get better and better at reflective design, to improve? You know, what does better mean? Well, to me, it means that when I go through a set of changes, I have a lower chance of introducing bugs. I can do it more quickly, so I have lower opportunity cost. I have more exits, so that I can do part way and decide, that's good enough, I can come back later. I don't have to push it all the way through. I made it better, I didn't make it perfect. So. For all of those, the thing that I can use to improve my own practice, iterate faster. So how fast can you go through those loops? What was that? Control the size of the change that you're making. Yeah, that is, yeah. What are the variables you can control? You can't really control the speed at which you think, but you can certainly control the size of the problem you're trying to solve. All right. Yeah. So work on small chunks. Work tiny. Iterate fast. And yeah? So the question is, if you've done this enough, can you eliminate step three? Because you're already, you know, able to predict what's going and go faster than that. So you can make any of those questions very, very quick and that you don't really think about answering the questions. They're obvious to you. And that certainly happens. on the other hand, when you think about this in terms of iterative loops, there's at least one important function of step three, and that is that you might need to execute it several times before you can go back to step two. Right? If nothing else, it's the label to go back to at the end of the loop. Right. Yeah?
Can you go too fast?
Can you go too fast? Do people think, can you go too fast? Only if you make a mistake at number five. What was?
Or if you're skipping steps.
If you're skipping steps, those would, can certainly bite you. Yeah. I heard something in the back, but I couldn't make it out.
Never.
Never? You can't go too fast. Yeah. Okay, so it's possible to exceed your current skills, where you might take one of these questions too quickly, and you would have come up with a better idea if you had taken some time. That certainly can be the case. As your skills improve and you're able to make those design decisions quicker, then too fast might become faster and faster from that perspective. Any other thoughts? You've never found it to be too fast for you yet.
I can't check in often enough.
Yeah, can't check in often enough. So how fast do you go when you're zooming along?
I'm trying to get it down to, you know, a few minutes, not 90 seconds by any.
So you're getting to it.
I try to get 10 minutes in.
So you're trying to get 10 minutes, but you're consistently hitting like 15, and on your good days you're hitting like 10, something like that. If you're lucky. Okay. Or that's your aspirational goal for the next month. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. My answer to the can you go too fast question is that you can certainly exceed the speed at which you are capable, of which you are capable running today. And then you will run into the problems of building bad design, you will make mistakes, you will skip steps, and all sorts of problems will ensue. And that can be either I exceed my speed, my own skill, or what happens if every time that I do a commit, I need to do a formal code review? What happens if every time I do a commit, I need to run a set of build verification tests that are written by QA, run over the course of 500 machine hours? Then there might be a too fast, right? So in the I might have too fast for the context currently. But is there an absolute too fast? I don't think so. I believe, it is my perspective at least, that you can go as fast as your current context allows. To do the next level of improvement, you will need to go faster, and that means you will need to change the context. You need to make that test suite run faster, speed up that build, find a better way to get the value that you're getting out of a code review without the cost of doing it. Maybe you do specific dedicated times. Maybe you code review a random sample. Maybe you do pair programming. Maybe you do, I mean, there are a bunch of different solutions that people will try that you can help change the context. So I don't think in an absolute sense you can ever go too fast. I find I'm far more productive at 90 seconds than I am at 3 minutes. And when I'm really flying and getting down to 40 seconds and that sort of thing, then it's even better. I don't know how I'm going to get below 30 seconds on any system ever. Typing the check-in comments accounts for way too much time at that point.
Why change it?
Why change what?
Why change that 40 seconds? Why make it faster?
Why keep going faster?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the reason that I keep going faster. And I keep working on iterating faster, is it helps me see one more smaller step, which helps me increase the provability of the step that I take, which decreases the risk. And I get more feedback cycles, and I learn more things, and I also learn a lot more about design.
At the abstract, I understand, but I mean when yeah. you're that
fast. When you're that fast, why go even faster?
Where's the value?
I will tell you once I get there. What I have found is that each speed that I run, it's been a while that I've been running faster than most people think is sane. and every time I go faster, I've found value in doing that. And I've learned more, and I've learned more about design, and I've found another rough spot in my process that I could improve, and I could speed up and get better productivity and better release rates and lower bug rates. And I don't know what it will be that the next step gives me. So far, it's always helped.
Is fast and quality opposed to each other?
are fast and quality opposed to each other? Not at this speed. So I want to prove that thing. I need to prove the step or I can't go on, right? So how can I possibly get proof in anything but really, really high quality system in 90 seconds, right? In order to get proof and work at that tiny speed or that tiny size, I need to have a very, very high quality bar. So it actually, the quality, increasing the quality allows me to go faster. The two work hand in hand. The big, nasty, ugly thing, yeah.
That's pretty hard, right?
Yeah.
To try to prove, I mean, you're not doing test-driven development, obviously, because that would take too long, right?
Right, I can't test the 17,000 lines, and certainly I can't write tests for every aspect of their behavior. Right.
So what would constitute
a proof in the context of that? Can someone think of some provable steps that I could take on that 17,000 line function? There are a couple of them. A mechanical mechanized refactoring such as extract method or rename. Yeah, if I'm using a tool that is able to operate not just on the text but on a semantic understanding of the language, and it can say that, yes, I can guarantee this executes exactly the same, that could work. Yeah. What are some other changes that I can make? Renames, yeah, that's one of the mechanical refactorings that works.
Contracts.
Putting in contracts,
in and out.
Or in a more general case, adding a test to anything that I don't have to change the code for, but just adding one more test that's one more case, right? That teaches me one aspect of the behavior. I might not have it fully under test, but I understand it a little better. Yeah. So there are a number of changes that I can make, even on that big, nasty beast. And in fact, if you look at Feathers' Working Effectively with Legacy Code, the whole book is dedicated to that sort of stuff. And so a lot of what he talks about is seams, understanding your system in terms of seams and how I can inject seams that are guaranteed to not change behavior, but allow me to decouple something in some way. You know, maybe all that this seam does is allows me to decouple the type of a variable that is used for storage from the type that is instantiated into it. And it does nothing else, right?
The only reason I ask is because I've seen several such functions myself in the past, and almost invariably they're using a lot of global variables.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's usually a horrible problem that I can't even conceive of getting through in 90 seconds.
Yeah, well,
with a proof.
Right, I agree. They are horrible, they're big, nasty, and the bigger and nastier they are, the harder it is to see what one step I could do. Adding a comment, that's another good one, yeah. Often these steps are very, very small. So it will take me a lot of steps to get that 17,000 line code thing under a reasonable facsimile of test.
Right.
But if I can prove each one of them, then I can have much higher confidence that in the sequence of doing that, I didn't introduce unexpected defects or so on.
Right. Integration or acceptance tests, maybe?
Integration or acceptance tests are another approach, yeah. Yeah, pinning tests. So actually, that 17,000 line beastie, what they chose to do was pinning tests. They had a bunch of area specialists in their test department that were testing aspects of behavior of their system related to this and had been for years and years and years. And they knew every single thing that happens. When you triple click on the right side of this particular thing, this is what the system does, right? And they were just masters of that. And so they had those people do a bunch of trap and record tests where they trapped every input, the whole message queue from the operating system, every input that was going in for a given initial state, and then they had a number of places where they injected log statements, and so they make sure the same log comes out. And they also injected global statement checks, where it will dump the entire global state of all those nasty global variables that it touches, because it touches a lot of them. and then they're able to pin the thing down while they start to do refactorings. And so then they can if they're going to go after this one section of the code, they can put a lot of log statements and a lot of those pinning things in place, play the tester's inputs over that, and record, here's exactly what the current system does when I throw my entire suite of testers at it. All right, now let's go ahead and make a change and ensure that the system does the same thing when those same pseudo testers go through. So that's one of the techniques that they used, because they didn't have good refactoring tools. Personally, I prefer refactoring tools because static analysis is stronger than that, but sometimes you don't have them. Yep.
Wouldn't it have been easier just to reverse engineer it?
sure. No. So this one is a good case study of that, a good example. So this particular thing is 17,000 lines of code now, because before the previous release of the product that it's in, it was 26,000 lines of code. And the people who are doing the changes to it now are the people who did that previous set of changes to it and also worked on it before that. And these people have like 9 or 10 years of experience with this function. They're specialists in this function. Right? It is a key function to the application, right? But it's nasty. In the previous release, they did a bunch of cleanup and whatever, and they felt they had a really, really good understanding of what they wanted to do with this. So he proposed a new design to his dev manager. And they talk through it and whatever. And it's a good design. And in fact, it is the design that they're implementing towards right now. and so dev manager asked, how long is it going to take? And they said, well, it's going to take about 4 weeks to implement the new design. And we're there. And they said, OK, and how long is it going to take to test? And he said, well, I made less invasive changes on it last release. It took us 10.5 months to stabilize. And we shipped a couple of bugs that were pretty darn embarrassing. And I'm pretty good at this function. I expect it's pretty similar this time. I'm a little better, but it's a more excessive change. And then he said, and what sort of defects are going to be there? Well, we're going to probably clean up some behaviors, and they won't work the same in the old system and the new. He said, well, this is directly core to the brand, the user experience of our application. Changes here that are not backwards compatible are going to confuse users and get people fired, like he was saying in the corner. So we can't make changes in the behavior. So that's out. So they went through this approach. They're currently working on with the refactoring and the pinning style of thing, and they've gotten they've now changed about. So they had 26 different target executables or whatever extraction steps that they were going to do. They've done 5 of them. In the process of doing that much code change in the previous thing, they would have introduced 10.5 months of destabilization, an unknown number of bugs, et cetera. In the process of doing it this way, they introduced 2 defects, found them both, and fixed them both within an hour. And both of them, they were able to backtrack to a fundamental process problem that allowed that one to slip through, and they won't have bugs like that slip through again. That's the advantage that they're getting. Now, the cost, instead of it taking 3 weeks for a 2-man team, it's going to take a 5-man team 6 weeks. But as compared to 3 weeks plus 10.5 months, that's a significant reduction in cost and a reduction in risk. Right. What was the something about successes? The success is not because of pinning tests. Pinning tests is one of the tools that they're using. The success is that they're working in small steps, improving each one as they go. Pinning tests is one of the mechanisms of proof that they have. They have a number of other ones. And as they do each type of step, they prove it in an appropriate way. Are we trying to apply it to any design change or just legacy code refactoring? So what's the difference between a legacy code refactoring and another design change?
A regular design change involving a relatively new system is not supposed to find a 70,000 line of code.
So time scale and scope of complexity. Yeah, that's really the only difference between the two is how complicated the change is. So what you're really asking is, do we do the same process for the easy cases as for the hard cases? Yeah. Well, why should we or shouldn't we? What are people's thoughts on that? Why should or shouldn't we use the same process and approach for the easy design changes as the harder design changes? We should because it's basically the same problem. It's just how long it's going to take, right?
The approach is the same. The approach shouldn't change.
The approach is the same and shouldn't change. Okay.
The scope and the time will change.
Right.
But I would argue that in this case, what we do is probably 90% sensing and 10% inventing, because we are making sort of a black box set of changes. We make a tweak. Is it broken yet? Nope. Another tweak. Is it broken yet? Why would I go that way? I would reverse this if the design was same, if the original design was same. I would do 90% inventing and 10% sensing, because I own my design. I can see what's happening in the system.
Okay, so I'm going to try and paraphrase, and tell me whether I get this right. So in the case of a legacy code system, there is a large amount of unknown. And so I spend a lot of time sensing and trying to just learn about that unknown stuff. Right? Whereas in a more greenfield, I'm doing a design change in well-tested code, there's much less unknown, and it's changing from a known state to another known state. And that therefore, perhaps it's a different process because I have more knowledge going in. Okay? That's your statement? Okay. What are people's thoughts on that? So I have a position, but I want to hear what others are. Don't you take care of the unknown during step two? Pretty much, yeah. Yeah?
I still think that the process on how you go about doing it, yes, those are all factors that are true. But how are you going to go and treat those things? How do you approach your design and everything else? Won't change. If it's not done correctly, if it's unknown and it's not done correctly, you're there to make it go to the state that you think is correct and it's working in the correct fashion. So the process itself, I think that's the question. The process itself.
Yeah. So the process is about the same. You might spend different time in different slices. I'd like just to ask one question right in this, which is, so what does it look like when you don't know? How does that show up? Does it show up as I know that I don't know, and I am afraid of and don't understand this system? Sometimes. I mean, it's 17,000 lines and it's ugly. What's the more common way it shows up? A bug?
You didn't understand what it did, so you wrote some new bugs.
I didn't understand what it did, and I wrote new bugs. I thought I knew. So the error case that's very common is I feel like this is green field. I fully understand the current system. I'm making a change to another system that I fully understand. Let's go. Except I don't actually fully understand the current system, and I don't know that I don't know that. And that's where a lot of bugs get introduced. Is that mismatch between developers' understanding of the current code and what the current code really does. And this process helps you. You don't have to know whether you know or not, right? Because you're sensing continually. And you'll discover as you go through, oh, I was wrong. Well, it's a good thing I didn't assume I was right. Is it safe to say that item 3 is really the only way you know? Perhaps. So it depends on, I would say that depends on the code that you're working with. So the only way that you really, really know is, yeah, I can identify the proof, and then it passes my level of proof. And If it doesn't, then it means that either I didn't understand enough the problem to write the right proof. I thought it would change just this one, the result of this one test, and it actually changed five tests. Clearly, I didn't understand the interactions of the system, right? Or it might mean that I just did the, I executed it wrong, right? So that is, that's certainly one of my primary sensing things, but it's not my only one. So for example, one of my next goals may be to write, to put some tests around there and sense its current behavior. So I'm learning about the system actually by accomplishing a few iterations through it. Right. So there are other ways that I'm going to find stuff out too.
But even when you know step three, like you think you know.
Yeah.
You see a green light and say, yeah, I did right. Well, actually, you didn't because it didn't fulfill the requirement, right?
Yeah, so there's always that chance, especially with new code, of dev implemented exactly what dev understood that needed to happen. Problem between dev and customer. Yeah, and so this sort of a process will drive a lot of bugs out of the problems between dev and keyboard, but it doesn't do anything for driving bugs out of the process between dev and customer. You got to be doing other things for that.
Yeah. I think you could use the same process to do the customer dev loop as well.
You could use a similar process for customer dev loop. Absolutely, you could. Yeah. And the ATDD stuff is an attempt to formalize that. Yeah.
Okay, so I've got to ask, you said you were getting down to like 40 seconds?
Mm-hmm. On a good day.
Okay.
90 seconds is typical.
You're measuring it by the check-in dates?
Yep.
And so if you figure 40 seconds for an 8-hour day, we're talking like...
And a lot of commits.
Like 1,600 changes or something like that? Or
yeah, it can be. Mm-hmm.
And you're actually seeing that...
I am using Git, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I am actually seeing that. Now, typically, I will be working in pairs, and I'll do 90-minute sessions and then a break because I want to be on the top of my game. And I mean, I can code well, and I can code for a while, but I will not be as smart after 4 hours as I was after in that first 90 minutes. So I'll take a break, which means that on an 8-hour day, it's not 8 hours and 1,600. And also, I don't hit 40 seconds consistently. I can hit 90 seconds fairly consistently. 90 seconds for 90 minutes? Yeah, I can do that. And show. Yeah, sometimes I'll change an expression. I won't even change a whole statement. Yeah, yeah. Take one provable step, prove it, check it in, keep going. And the reason is that my next provable step I might screw up. How often do I poll? As often as I can. So typically, I will do a poll on every commit cycle. I'll do a push poll, or pull push. Yeah.
Minimize
the merge and all that cost. Yeah, yeah. Especially if I've got other people on my team that are going at the same speed, then we really got to do a poll really fast. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So okay.
Then you're next.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a new screen, or I don't know, if you do UI or
yes, or UI to database to networks to whatever.
So I'm assuming that when you're talking about a new screen, you're going to do a different. You're still kind of doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm still going that fast.
High speed check-in.
Yeah. So often if I'm working on a new screen. I will start thinking about how I'm going to block out the layout, and I'll put a couple of blocks in the right place and check some of those in, and then I'll put a couple more and put a little bit of text on them to identify what they are. And then one of those is going to be an image, so I'll grab the image and put that in the right place and check that in. And then another one's going to be a dynamic data table, so I'll convert it into a static empty data table. And then I'll bind that to the data source just with the data bind statement, and then all dot, 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 dot. And so that actual design will evolve over the course of an hour or a half an hour, and often I have a designer sitting there right next to me because I'm pairing, and so we're evolving the design, we're playing with something. It's like, let's try this sort of change, make the change, right? So those commits are very, very quick, but the overall process is a gradual, smooth going towards, as we figure out where we're going. You know, we're planning and we go towards whatever our current definition is.
So you could actually play, you could actually take all your commits and generate a
cool movie. Yeah.
your whole day.
Yes, I have a couple of movies of some of my katas. I don't have it on live code, mostly due to issues with showing live code. But yeah, I have some of those movies around. You can see me go through. Does the absence of bugs equate to the quality of design? No. But is it related? Yeah. So one of the measures that I use for good design is that when I continue to do more development on it, I don't introduce as many bugs as I would with some other design that is not as good. It's not the only measure of good design, but it's certainly one of them. You know, another one is, as you were talking about way at the beginning, when I want to make changes, how far and expansive does that change? Or does the design have the good decoupling to firebreak the change so that I can make small changes easily? And there are a bunch of those different things that matter. But certainly one of them is, you know, is this going to fool the dev and get them to write bugs? Or this is going to be what they expect and get them to write bug-free code, right? Yeah. So one last part. Yeah, at home. Yeah.
Do you ever have like design disagreements?
Oh, sure. That's not usually why I end up sleeping on the sofa. you learn to work them out, right? Just like any other team. So I'm going to skip over a couple of things here because we're out of time. So just want to close with a summary. We talked a lot about the process and the recipe to go through. That's, you know, if you're going to just take something and just try executing it, that's a good recipe to start with. It's not the final solution. It works pretty well as a recipe to start with, but the mentation, the way that will help you go towards success over time is work tiny, prove every step, stop when you're done, and go faster. Work tiny is about small chunks and higher speed. So if you do those things better today than you did them yesterday, every single day, then you'll eventually get to the ability to have far fewer defects introduced as you change the design, and your code becomes more fluid. So thank you very much. I'm going to be around for conversations and questions as long as people are interested, and probably sometime tomorrow. And good luck. Hopefully you can apply some stuff on your real code when you get home. Thank you.